Welcome to Women with Balls, where I, Katie Ball, speak to today's trailblazers. When it comes to retirement, working out how much you will need to set aside can seem like a monumental task. These days, the average person has between 8 to 10 jobs over their lifetime, people are living longer, and the median retirement age at 65 and life expectancy at 80. Health problems in old age can be costly, care responsibilities are rising, and the cost of living crisis is adding to the financial burden, not to depress listeners already. So what should people think about when planning for their pension? What challenges do they face, and where are the solutions? There's also an aspect here of women the most likely to suffer from pension inequality, and single women being the poorest of all pensioners on average. Almost a fifth of working age private sector employees do not do any pension saving in any given year, and a third of people expect to retire with only a state pension, whatever that will be. Joining me now to shine a light on some of these pension inequalities and what can be done about it is Wendy Chamberlain, Liberal Democrat spokesman for Work and Pensions, Jackie Leeper, CEO of Embark Group and MD of Pensions at Scottish Widows, both parts of Lloyds Banking Group, and Lauren Wilkinson from the Pensions Policy Institute and co-author of the Underpensioned Report. Thank you to my panel for joining me today. Wendy, just to kick us off, I wonder if you could talk us through the challenges you are seeing when it comes to the pensions challenge at the moment for those looking at what they might have when they get to that point.
Yeah. If we look specifically at the gender pension gap, why does it exist? Well, it exists because we know that there's a gender pay gap. And the reason for that, I think, is quite well illustrated by my own work career. You know, after university, I was a police officer for 12 years. But in that time, I took maternity leave for my two children and I returned to work on a part-time basis. I then left the police and took a 2.5 year career break where I wasn't working, so therefore not making any contributions to my pension. And then I've had two employers since then before I was elected as an MP. And I think, as you rightly said in your introduction, that more portfolio career approach that people generally are taking is part of the challenge. So different pension pots in different places, auto enrolment has definitely helped. But when we look at women specifically, more likely to be working part-time, more likely to have caring responsibilities which require them often to leave the workplace. And then just, I do feel that we've got a tax and pension system that isn't really set up for dealing with women's lives. But one of the things that people maybe aren't aware of is if you are the non-paying parent or the non-working parent in relation to child benefit and you know that you're not going to qualify for child benefit, if you don't actually apply for it, you won't get your national insurance contributions while you're out of the workplace. So the government is obviously advertising and trying to encourage people to do that. But for many women, they won't realise that that's an issue until further down the line when they're looking at their state pension.
And Jackie, clearly, as I mentioned in the introduction, there is an argument that women can be the worst affected here. But I mean, there are lots of groups struggling right now when it comes to generational challenges, when it comes to changes in the system. As someone who's worked in the pension sector for many years, what are probably the challenges across different groups that you're seeing come up the most?
Yeah, so I mean, generally in the UK, people are just not saving adequately for retirement. So particularly when we look at the cut over from what would have been defined benefit pensions, so final or final salary, some people call them, that are very generous employer-sponsored schemes, to, you know, now it is a sort of self and personal responsibility through defined contribution. And whilst your employer will contribute, auto enrolment has been probably the single biggest policy intervention in the last sort of 10, 15 years positively, you know, bringing 10 million people into the scope of saving for a pension. It doesn't go far enough. The contribution levels are pretty small. And actually, I have a little concern that some people think that just because they've been automatically enrolled, that's them sorted. You know, they're on track when actually the contribution levels at 8% are nowhere near enough to provide even a basic sort of lifestyle in retirement. I think that's compounded just by, it's quite a complex landscape. So certainly in our experience, people find it difficult to navigate their way through what they feel is quite overwhelming. You know, how much should they save? There's all different types of regimes depending on which generation you are and how long you've been saving into a pension, if you have been saving. And obviously some people use other means of preparing for retirement. You know, they might think property is a good way of going. They might have other types of savings and investments. And generally speaking, I think all of that contributes to quite a lot of inertia and sort of procrastination. And then, as Wendy said, you know, no matter what data point you look at, women are worse off at every single stage, whether that is the amount being saved in the current situation, so how much people save towards retirement and pay is a big part of that, but also the sort of disrupted lifestyle points that Wendy calls out, you know, so motherhood and various other things, actually, when relationships break down. And actually, even later on in life, women tend to be the primary carers for parents as well. So, you know, we've got this kind of double thing going on. It's not just children. It's also at the other end where you might have elderly parents and you need to take time out or balance that with your career. So there's lots of factors, I think, in there that contribute towards what is quite a substantial gap for women.
And Lauren, before we dig into some of those examples there, where there's a lot to say, I suppose from some of the research you've done in the work, do you think there is a point there which is just lots of people just do not realise how much they need to save to have a pension that will support them in later life?
Absolutely. We know that engagement levels are really far too low. And as Jackie has said, many people think that because they've been automatically enrolled, that they are doing enough. They think that that minimum contribution rate that they're saving at automatically will be enough for them to have an adequate and sustainable retirement income. But as we know, that's not the case. And particularly for women, where they've got even lower levels of saving because of those gaps in employment, this is a real concern.
And Jackie, if I just go back to you when we were talking about defined benefits, defined contribution, there is a particular age group that we had, for example, James Kirk writing in The Spectator about the time bomb for Gen X. Gen X, we're defining, I hope, as 1965 to 1980, the year you're born. And I hope that two of my guests on the panel don't mind me outing them as being born in this in this period. So Jackie, to you first, as a member of Gen X, why is it particularly tricky if you are in that age group now when it comes to looking at your pension?
So Gen X is right in the sweet spot of the population where you're likely to have crossed over into defined contribution. I think in a nutshell, that's the single biggest challenge. And I'll use my own circumstances. I've been working for 35 years. And the first sort of 15 years of that, I was in a final salary pension. And I thank my lucky stars now, actually, because it is still going to be the significant part of my own retirement savings. Now, I'm the eldest of six people in my family, six children, and I'm the only one that has any final salary, just to bring to life. That's the real impact for that Gen X population. So that means that for those populations, which are also all pre-auto enrolment as well, there's a significant percentage that wouldn't have had any pension at all, and a number that will have been on the defined contribution schemes, probably under-saving, though, in terms of contribution levels. And if you think about it, Gen X are now of an age group where it's really difficult to catch up. So there's a brilliant rule of thumb that we use to try and make it simple for people in the pensions landscape. And that is, when you start saving for a retirement or towards a pension, you should save at least half your age as a percentage from when you start. So if you're 40 when you start saving in, you need to save 20%. If you're 20, you need to save 10% because you have this sort of compound interest effect. So if you're in Gen X and you weren't in a pension scheme and you have only started saving in the auto-enrolment regime, the chances are you've started much later and need to contribute a much higher amount. And that's really difficult if you're coming from a standing start, really.
I think Jackie has hit the nail on the head. You know, my police... my police pension is final salary. And I remember people saying to me, you know, never fold that into any other scheme, like leave that exactly where it is. And I think there are also societal factors at play here. So we talk about divorced women and how breakdowns of relationships, but we also have to remember that increasingly relationships are not based on, you know, marriage and a formal contract. So end of relationships. And what you tend to find is that women are the primary caregiver when a relationship breaks down, so their focus when they're deciding on division of assets can be quite property focused, that they want to maintain the family home, and as a result they're likely to give up their rights within the pension of the man, let's be honest, who has worked full time for a period of time and has built up a better basis. And yes, I think what we're seeing as we go later into Gen X and beyond is the fact that property is not an opportunity for some to make those savings and investments. But it's interesting because, you know, the triple lock is something that when we talk about pensions in Parliament, we end up talking about the state pension rather than the complexities that we are discussing here today. And one of the reasons why, you know, the Lib Dems and other parties are supportive of it is because I feel that from a generational perspective, we are talking about pensioners currently are more likely to have had a final salary pension, as Jackie outlined, so do feel better off. But actually, if we've got increasingly people who haven't made up enough through their own private pensions or haven't been able to get on the property ladder, it least knowing that there is a state pension that is kept up to date with inflation and the cost of living, is actually going to be increasingly important for people as they face a pension age.
And let me just build on that, Katie, just to give a few statistics to just endorse what Wendy said there. So we know when we look at our research that 39% of women, should I say, are not on track for even the minimum amount in retirement. So that's the sort of £12,000 that the PLSA have set out as a minimum living standard that you would need in retirement. So 39%. Now that rises to 60% for divorced women. So it's a really major jump, in 75% for single mothers. And a big part of that is when relationships break down, as Wendy says. And actually, I think this is probably one of the most depressing stats I've got, that 83% of women that have gone through divorce say they didn't discuss pension assets in the divorce process because they didn't realise that they were actually part of the marital assets. And now, that might not be completely true in the grand scheme that maybe the lawyers did discuss it, and as Wendy said, maybe the property was traded off for the pension. But it really is one of the big contributors to why divorced women are at that 60%.
The clean break aspect sometimes of divorce as well, when a relationship has broken down, is one of the drivers for that too.
So potentially a lack of awareness means that people are missing out, particularly women, when it comes to those conversations. Lauren, I'd like to bring you in here, because not that we want to add too much to the gloom of the challenges, we will get to some solutions. But obviously you were the co-author of PPI's Under Pensions report, which looked at the gender pensions gap. So we've heard the inequalities, some of the problems there. Does that sound about right to you? Are there any that we're missing?
Yeah, I'll just provide a bit of background. I think we've covered most of the main inequalities, but just to kind of give a view as to how large the gap is and how significant the challenge is. So as we've said, most of women's greater risk of being underpensioned is driven primarily by inequalities in the labour market and gender divisions of labour. So women are less likely to be in employment than men, and among those who are in employment, much more likely to be working part-time. So we adjusted participation in the labour market to account for those part-time hours. And we found that for women, labour market participation is just 46% compared to 74% for men. We also see that that participation gap varies considerably depending on marital and parental status, underlining the fact that this is primarily driven by those gendered divisions of labour and childcare. So women who are parents are much less able to work than other women. And similarly, we see men who are single fathers have less opportunity to work than other men. But where we see the biggest gap is men in a couple with children, who actually have a greater activity rate even than men with no children. So we're seeing sort of a motherhood penalty and a fatherhood bonus. So the participation gap we see is the lowest between men and women who are single with no children. It's only 8% there, but highest between men and women in couples with children. It's 45%. So really substantial. The gender gap in labour market participation also varies across the life course, and that further underlines the fact that this is primarily driven by those gendered divisions of labour. So the gap starts to widen significantly from about age 25, and that coincides with the time that many would be having their first child. And then it remains substantial throughout midlife up until sort of the mid-50s, when most people's children would be reaching adulthood. And interestingly, that narrowing of the gap that we then see in the 50s is not because women are coming back into the labour market, but actually because men are beginning to leave it with early retirement and things like that. Of course, the gender pay gap is also a really significant issue there. So we see lower levels of pay over the course of working life that limits the amount of women who are able to contribute to a pension, and also how much they're able to contribute. So we see between the birth of a first child and their 18th birthday that the pay gap increases by around 20% between mothers and fathers. So really substantial there too. And as has been mentioned, divorce really compounds the inequalities that we see stemming from those gendered divisions of labour, because many women have made sacrifices based on the assumption that they'll be supported by their higher earning partner's pension savings. And then in many cases, I think in the vast majority of cases, it's either not considered at all in the divorce, or they make those trade-offs that have been mentioned to be able to keep the marital home or things like that. So it's really quite a significant challenge. And we did find that if the gender pay gap was solved, obviously that's quite challenging to do, then women would be able to make up the gap by about a third. So that would significantly solve it. And if we could solve participation challenges, then they would have roughly equal to men. So really very much driven by those labour market inequalities.
Yeah. And I think it's also because women are more likely to leave the job market for a period, it's then much more difficult to get back in. And when they do get back in, it's often, you know, not in the same career path that they were on. So they've just not even stepped out off the escalator. You know, the escalator doesn't exist anymore in terms of being able to make career progression.
I was just going to add two stats on that just to back that up. So I think we would see 37% of women leave their job to look after children at some stage. That's a sort of broader percentage. But of the ones that return, about half return part-time. So I think that then feeds through into the gender pay issue. So you're either then stuck at a certain level where you can't take on more responsibility and go for those sort of higher responsibility positions. And you have this very sort of uneven career curve with women compared to men, where they literally just have these step ups as they go through their career because it's a continuous working trajectory, really. So I think those are some of the big challenges that feed through into that gender pay gap.
And I think there's also work to be done to understand the kind of reasons behind why people make the decisions they do about who takes time out of work, who makes those sacrifices. Because interestingly, the data suggests that even in cases where the woman has higher earning potential or higher current earnings, she is still the one that takes time out of work rather than the husband. And I think we're starting to see some shifts in societal attitudes about those divisions of labour. I know, you know, anecdotally among friends that it is more likely for men to be taking time out of work, either just for paternity leave or as the main caregiver on an ongoing basis. But we're still seeing, you know, even where quite generous paternity leave is offered by employers, I think take up is about 2%. So, you know, it's really significantly low. So I think it would be worth us looking into actually why those decisions are made to understand how to support women to get back into the workforce sooner.
My last employer before I was elected brought in shared parental leave. It was 6 months that both parents could take. And I think without some of those really bold interventions, you're just not giving couples the opportunity to have the debate.
So, Jackie, is it fair to say some of this comes down to a lack of awareness? I wonder, do you find a situation where women, I suppose, particularly, but it can be across the board, you know, get to, I don't know, what is the age where the penny drops and you're starting to look at your pension and thinking, because most of my friends, I say someone, you know, in her 30s, I can't speak for everyone, but in their mindset of, we ticked the box, there's money going in, not looking at the total, perhaps because I think it would be depressing, but also because it's just not my main concern right now. What is the point that people start to think, you know, oh God, I don't actually have what I need? And is that quite common at the moment?
Yeah, so we would see, I would say, that trigger point around the mid-40s. And obviously it varies. Some women are earlier, some are later. But, you know, well, actually, how much have I got saved? And actually, one of the challenges in today's environment is also, if you've been moving jobs, you have pensions all over the place. So even trying to work out what you've got is a bit of a challenge. So one of the things that we do is we try and encourage people to do the, first of all, work out what you've got. Can you track down those old pensions? Have you checked your state pension forecast, for example? Work out what you've got. Then you need to have an idea on what you think you need. That's actually been a really challenging thing. But actually, the PLSA standards that I mentioned earlier, and there's some brilliant calculators even on the Money Helper website that the government have set up, really help people, I think, get a sense on how much they're going to need. And that allows you to say, well, you know, if you've saved £50,000, how's that likely to grow until you intend to retire, and how much do you need and to have the sort of standard of living that you're aspiring to? And there are some nice simple things in there that people can engage with, and that's where they start to do the, oh my gosh, I'll need to up my contributions, and you know, I need to think about what else I can do. So certainly a lot of the bigger employers are sort of dialing up their support, trying to make sure that they communicate more and engage their workforce, including women and other categories of people that need to save more. Because actually, the ideal thing would be to save more when you're younger, when you've got longer for it to accumulate, actually.
And Wendy, on that point that Jackie just made about not knowing, if you've had lots of different jobs, and you mentioned some of yours, you've got a very varied career.
Yes, not a career politician, I think you can definitely say that.
Pots here and there. I mean, the Association of British Insurers estimates that over 2.8 million pensions worth about £10,000 each are currently lost. So I suppose it highlights of complexities and perhaps why the system's not.
Yeah,
so if you've done, you know, a couple of weeks, I've no idea, but when I did like a month of shifts at one place, you know, it's quite hard to know where.
And obviously auto enrollment will increase that, because potentially when you did that month, you weren't registered into a pension. But yeah, it's a huge challenge. And there was a Pensions Act brought in the first session of this parliament. It had gone through the Lords in the first instance, but you know, the pension dashboards were part of that. That work to actually deliver that is still not completely finalised. So that will give people the opportunity to, you know, see all their pots in the one place. One of the other challenges is when people realise that they haven't got enough or that they need to top up their contributions from a state pension perspective. The government needs to make that as straightforward as possible. And I think, you know, we're probably all aware on here, you know, the people trying to get through to the helpline, trying to make top-up contributions, not getting a record of those contributions, and that creating a degree of anxiety. And it's good that the government have extended that opportunity to top up through to April next year. But I think the challenge here is this one where, and I think I've said this to you before, Katie, is pension indicates end of life and it indicates, you know, death, and we're just not very good as a society about talking about those things. So I think unless we make things as simple and as straightforward as possible for people, we shouldn't be surprised as politicians when people then don't engage and find themselves in poor circumstances. But you know, there's lots of talk about, should we be following Australia, should, you know, a pension pot be following you as an individual through your career, or different ways of bringing it together. I don't think there's a straightforward answer to that, but quite clearly, if we want to reduce people's reliance on the state pension as they enter pension age, it's quite clear that we'd need to do a lot more to incentivise people to save.
And Lauren, on, I suppose, some of the potential problems, we talked about Gen X, and I think it's fair to say they don't get as media attention as some, but despite that, I want to talk about Gen Z and millennials, because do you think it's potentially, you know, one of the problems, particularly with those generations, is that because there's a lot less property ownership now, people getting on the property ladder, there is a quite high chance that, you know, when you have millennials, Gen Z get to the point that they are using their pension, they're going to be paying rent as well. You know, that there is a point where they're not going to necessarily have the assets to fall back on. And that means they're going to be even more reliant on what could potentially be a small pension if they don't get ahead of it.
Absolutely. We are expecting, with Gen X even, so much sooner than millennials and Gen Z, that we will be seeing far more people renting in retirement or still paying off a mortgage, as we're seeing people get onto the housing ladder later. And in many cases, not getting on until they receive an inheritance much later in life that enables them to do so. This is a really significant concern because we know that people don't have enough to be able to provide that basic income by the PLSA standards that have been mentioned. So if you add in housing costs to that, this is going to be a real struggle for many people. And also it comes with that insecurity of housing as well, which in later life can be really challenging, ensuring that it meets your needs as your health potentially declines, and not being able to do so in rented accommodation can be really challenging.
And Jackie, I saw you nodding your head there, and it was Gen X too.
I was, because as Lauren just said, the PLSA updated the living standards a couple of weeks ago, I think, to really show that, you know, that 12,000, if you're still renting, is probably closer to 16,000, actually, that you will need just for a minimum standard. And when we say minimum standard, we're talking no car, no fancy holidays, literally being able to heat your home and eat. We're not talking anything frivolous whatsoever. So it is a bit of a time bomb.
Lauren, just one point, which is just, what about the self-employed? Because I think in a way, have we got much to suggest that can be even, I think, probably harder to think about putting that money aside for a pension, because it's not being something suggested by the employer?
Absolutely. So the self-employed are another group that we do look at in our underpensioned index, alongside people with multiple jobs and people with disabilities, carers, and people from ethnic minority backgrounds. So a real range of people at risk. But for the self-employed, this is a real concern because, as we said, engagement is really low across the board, particularly for the self-employed who don't have the option of automatic enrolment. They can't automatically enrol themselves as their own employer. And we know that savings levels among this group are particularly low. I think the main concern for many self-employed people, aside from the sort of inertia and putting it off until later, is also about the liquidity that they need in their finances. So I know that there have been trials run in the past to look at options for pension saving that would allow them a bit more of that accessibility and liquidity to those savings prior to retirement that would support their business needs. But that's not something that has been taken forward, I believe.
And Wendy, before I come to the advice point of this, just on the triple lock, you spoke in favour of it and the Lib Dems do support it. At the moment, so do Labour and the Tories. There's no suggestion that anyone's going to put a sledgehammer to in the party manifestos now we're in election year. But there is a question about intergenerational fairness and whether it is actually affordable. Do you really think that is a sustainable cost for the next, you know, 5-10 years and fair to young people?
Well, it's interesting. What was the triple lock brought in to do? It was brought in to raise the levels of state pension, particularly for women, because as we've just discussed quite eloquently, women are more likely to have to rely on their state pension in later life. And has it caught up yet? I would argue that it hasn't. So there's clearly still a need and requirement for the triple lock. I get the arguments about intergenerational fairness, but I do also feel that we've made the case for the fact that the state pension needs to be of a sufficient level in the longer term, because actually more people are potentially going to be relying on it unless we make the change that need to be made to incentivise saving for pensions.
And if we look at how the state pension replacement rates compare in the UK to other countries, we are much lower than most other OECD countries. So this is a real concern. So we're maybe looking at people having to find about 50% of their working age income in order to reach the replacement rates that they would need to be targeting. So I think the triple lock is obviously still very important, as Wendy has said. The other thing I think to consider is the fact that we talk a lot about intergenerational issues with the triple lock, but actually it will benefit younger generations too. And actually, given the rate of inflation and how that will ratchet up over time, that if there isn't something such as the triple lock in place, then actually it's younger generations who will most suffer from the decline in value of the state pension.
Now, I want to come around to each of you as the final part of this podcast, which is obviously listening to all the stuff. I think it can seem very complicated, quite overwhelming, and probably... Well, we want to make everyone enjoy our podcast, but for some, probably quite an unnerving listen because people are wondering what they should do about it and where to get ahead. So, I mean, perhaps starting with you, Jackie, there's obviously going to financial advisor. It seems advice and awareness, that divorce point you made was really interesting, which is not knowing perhaps in negotiations that the pension pot is something that should be talked about. What do you think are the most practical steps people can take right now when they're worrying about this?
So I have three things I always say to people. So start off, find out what you've got. So get the baseline, how, you know, round up all your pensions, go on and check your state pension. Have an idea on what you think you need. So, you know, do that little calculator that works out how much income you think you're going to need for the lifestyle that you're aspiring to. That'll tell you what the gap is. And then that helps you plan what steps you can take. And you don't need to take them all at once. Don't get overwhelmed. But, you know, it would be starting with, can you pay a bit more in? Are you maximising anything from your employer? So if you're in employment, quite often employers do contribute more and are more generous than the auto-enrolment levels. And they might have a matching contribution structure, for example, where if you pay six, they'll pay six, that sort of thing. Please look into that, because that is a fantastic way to boost your savings in your pension, and it doesn't all have to come from you. So those are some of the steps that I would say. If you are worried about losing track of all your pensions, consolidate them. That's a really easy thing to do, and actually for the majority of people, it can really help them keep track on how much they need to save for retirement. So those are some of the things that I would suggest.
I'll sort of probably talk about it more from a political side of things, but I think my first bit of advice was, if you're not already saving into a pension, do it, start today. You know, don't procrastinate, feel the fear, because the longer you leave it, as Jackie and Lauren have explained, the more challenging it becomes. But, you know, I do think we do need to think about pension sharing and divorce and cohabitation separations as well. And I know that there's a review on England and Wales on the law at the moment in relation to that, but that's something I think needs to be looked at in Scotland too, whether it needs to be a sort of opt-out rather than an opt-in in terms of pension considerations. Jonathan Gullis brought forward a private member's bill in the last session of Parliament looking at expanding auto-enrolment and lowering the lower earning limit. The government is kind of consulting on that. I think obviously the cost of living, is it right to expect people to be contributing more to their pension? But I think that's something that we need to move forward to. And we need to think about what employer contributions look like for people who are on low earnings. And just basically, I think what we've all explained today is auto-enrolment is a good start, but it's not the be-all and end-all, and actually we need employers and individuals to be making more contributions. Something in the region of 6% on each side would take you up to 12%, which would be much better. And then I think it is around to those gender issues around, you know, the differing nature of women and work. So I know Baroness Drake had been looking at something about how do you make national insurance contributions potentially for state pensions for unpaid carers, because they're obviously not in the workplace at all. I brought forward a private members bill in the last session that gives people who are unpaid carers the right to request time off for their employers for the first time. It's a very small step. We would like to see that unpaid leave become paid. But if that is a small chink that lets people stay in the workplace for longer while they're caring, that can only be a good thing. And then childcare. It continues to be an issue in terms of affordable childcare that lets families make the right decisions for both parents in terms of working. And those are part of the solutions that, that keep people in the workplace. I mean, frankly, the only reason I'm able to be doing the job that I do, particularly as a Scottish MP, is because my husband is semi-retired. And so he is doing everything at home. Plus, I have older teenagers now who are kind of not quite so needy as potentially they used to be.
And Lauren, I'm going to come to you for the final word on the advice. And I wondered, picking up to your point earlier, if, you know, that point about having those perhaps difficult conversations with your partner about who is taking on the load when it comes to career breaks, childcare and others is going to be a key part of them.
Absolutely. I think that there's definitely further research to be done to understand the reasoning behind those decisions. But then in terms of on an individual basis, having those conversations to understand the impact of taking time out of work rather than just deciding that it will be the wife or the female partner. I think in terms of other aspects that haven't already been covered, there are a few policy options that we looked at in the latest underpensioned report. So one of those, as Wendy touched on, was around employer-only contributions for lower earners, because we know that women are far less likely to be eligible for automatic enrolment. And for most women, that's because they're earning below that 10,000 threshold, but they're missing out on the employer contribution as well, even though they might not be in a position to make an employee contribution themselves. Other options could be around a family carer top-up, so making pension contributions on behalf of women that are taking time out of work. Obviously, there's costs associated with that, so there's trade-offs involved with all of these policies. And one other one that we're looking at in an upcoming briefing note is household pension pots. So this would be a shared pension pot that both partners would contribute to in different rates based on their earnings or whether they're in work, but both would have an automatic 50% right to that pension pot. There'd be no question in divorce about how that would be split. It would just be automatic. So those are a few of the policy options that we've been exploring.
And with that, thank you to Wendy, Jackie and Aaron for joining today.